chemical companies are currently enjoying record margins thanks to disrupted production and interrupted supply chains, which are making availability more important than price. How long can the party go on? I'm Will Beecham, and also in this week's podcast, Europe chemical prices are now far higher than other regions, and there are fears that the region's being almost cut off from global supply chains by the logistics crisis. And the pandemic has led to a baby bust rather than the predicted baby boom. Why should chemical companies care about that? Joining me to discuss these issues this week, I've got Paul Hodges, Chairman of New Normal Consulting, John Richardson, our Senior Consultant in Asia, and Nigel Davis, our ICIS Insight Editor. So I'll start with you this week, John. You've been looking at margins for the global polypropylene industry and published a really interesting graph this week on your blog showing how margins are breaking historical records. It looks like up to $2,000 a ton in the US earlier this year in the wake of the polar storm. What would you say is driving these fantastic levels of profitability around the world?
Well, it's really demand and supply, surprisingly. Demand is a lot stronger than people had expected when the pandemic began. Packaging into white goods, people at bored in lockdowns, buying lots of, you know, washing machines made from polypropylene, but a big boost in packaging, and of course the PP non-woven face mask issue. So the polypropylene demand has been much better than we'd expected because of the pandemic. But then also these chronic supply issues, the winter storms in the US, more long-term, the loss of propylene because of the, you know, reduced FCC production of gasoline because of the pandemic, you know, reduced transportation demand. We've had quite a few outages that have added to it. And now on top of that in Europe, you've got cracker turnarounds that were delayed from last year because of the pandemic into the second quarter of this year. So we really have a lot of petrochemical price inflation at the moment. Yeah, it's remarkable. You know, nobody would have expected the industry to be in this situation. This was supposed to be the year when we saw a lot of polypropylene capacity coming on stream, last year as well, when we thought that polypropylene would kind of head the way that we thought polyethylene would head in terms of into oversupply.
And that price inflation could perhaps be tempered by China's increasing self-sufficiency in global markets. How worried are you about the huge amount of capacity that China's adding?
Well, it's just huge, as you say, Will. And if you look at the various scenarios for polypropylene imports into China, they could go from 6.6 million tonnes last year down to around 4 million tonnes this year quite easily. Perhaps less than that, because of the big increase in domestic capacity. Depends what you should assume around operating rates and demand growth, but that capacity is coming. And as soon as 2026, if you assume what we call unconfirmed capacity happens, right, China becomes a net exporter of PP by about 900,000 tonnes by 2026. It might not happen. Some of those projects that are unconfirmed may not happen. The operating rates may be lower. But what we do know is their import dependency will go down substantially. And this is really bad news for the South Koreans, the Saudis, Taiwan, Japan to a lesser extent, India to a lesser extent, Singapore is a big exporter of PP to China. And China accounted last year, we estimate, for 43% of total global net imports of polypropylene. It was the biggest market for imports in the world. Second was Europe. Turkey by itself was third because it's a fairly big country with very little production. But if you take that, you know, if you assume that China reaches more or less self-sufficiency, yeah, so it goes down to 1 million tons of imports, 1.5 million, which is very, very possible. What happens to all those displaced volumes? And it's not just in polypropylene, it's the same in potentially monoethylene glycol. That's a bit more questionable perhaps, but definitely the case in paraxylene, definitely the case in styrene. You know, there's a scenario like Iran and China together push towards self-sufficiency in HTP and low-density PE by maximizing production and capacity in both countries. Iran sends lots of cheap polyethylene to China as part of this new deal. So you have a situation emerging now where China, if it wants to, can push the world into petrochemical deflation over the next few years. So at the moment, we have these very tight markets. We have, you know, these fantastic margins. It all depends what China does with that new production, that new capacity.
And just on the timeline, you know, it's like it's a real party at the moment if you're producing these chemicals in terms of margins. When do you think, or when do you expect that China ramp up to take place? It seems to have been a bit delayed, doesn't it?
I think what's been delayed by, Will, has been demand growth has been better than expected. So, I mean, last year in polypropylene, demand growth was around 13%. Yeah. And I think what we originally expected was around 4%. So even though domestic production was up by, 12% last year, the demand growth was so great, it didn't matter. So imports were up by 27%. So, you know, a lot of polypropylene had to go to China to come back out as finished goods because of the booming pandemic-related demand for exports. So it really depends. I think we could have another great year for demand in China. It doesn't look like it at the moment. The first few months don't point in that direction, but it may pick up later in the year. So we may get away with it for another year, but the capacity is coming. So it could be as early as this year that we see a sharp fall in imports, depending on demand growth in China. But it's coming over the next few years. Paraxylene is massive capacity increase last year, huge. I think we'll see a big fall in imports in paraxylene this year, certainly.
Thank you. You've also done some other analysis this week looking at the price differentials between different regions. And you're showing that Europe and Turkey prices are, the differential is like record-breaking levels compared to, say, China. And just focusing in on Europe, we've got a lot of force majeures. We've got the container issue. And I just wonder if you think there's a danger that Europe's getting kind of cut off from the rest of the world. And what would happen if consumer demand grew really strongly in Europe in that kind of context?
Yeah, I mean, it's cut off from the world because if you're a South Korean polypropylene exporter, for example, or a buyer of polypropylene wanting to buy from South Korea, you know, could the South Korean exporter even find a container? How much would it cost? Would it, you know, equal arbitrage despite the really high European prices? How long would it take to get there? So it's in effect become almost a closed off market because of these container freight issues. And interesting what you say about demand. I mean, if everybody starts spending the money they've saved during the pandemic, as we come out of lockdown, or lots of people did. The FT was saying there's $5.4 trillion of excess consumer savings in the world. So people come out of lockdown, bit of revenge spending, people spending like crazy. It's going to make these supply chain issues even worse because all the containers are in the wrong place around the world and there's not enough containers anyway. And, you know, the whole system's not working. So you could see this adding to consumer price inflation. But more importantly, I think, could you buy the new game console? Would it be available? And there's also a semiconductor shortage we could consider. So from a European perspective, you could see the, you know, this kind of stranded market almost. A lot of pressure from the demand side as people spend more money coming out of lockdowns. The supply might not be even there to meet that demand. And we've got real price inflation coming in, consumer price inflation coming in.
Nigel, maybe I could get some comments from you on Europe. Last week, Covestro upped its own profits guidance. And as John's just been describing, the supply-demand balance is pretty extreme, it's pretty favourable, really, if you can actually make and sell products in Europe. How do you think 2021 might play out for the European chemical sector?
Well, but given the situation in terms of prices, I think it's looking a lot stronger financially for companies than it widely expected. Remember, last year was pretty dire towards the middle of the year, but then the pickup was very strong. And I was looking at some analysis by Credit Suisse earlier this week, and they were saying that across the companies that they look at and the products that they look at, so it's not just petrochemicals, but a broader spread of chemicals, they said current commodity chemical product spreads are 20% above the mid-cycle April 2016 to April 2021 average. So, you know, we're seeing significant sort of spread or margin inflation through, not just, we talked about polymers just now, but, you know, through multiple chains, you know, from things like cyclohexane through to other key commodity chemicals. I think a lot of it has still got to do with the fact that you know, we're just not seeing the interregional trade playing the role that it has played in the past to balance these markets out. And Europe has come to rely more and more on imports in various product lines over the years for various reasons. And of course, the polar storm in the US. And we're still only seeing the issues there are not by no means resolved. And we're seeing quite a few companies still with force majeure in place and only slowly lifting those force majeure now. So, you know, not being able to get the trade in from other parts of the world, their demand is there. I mean, you know, you look at the ethylene demand across the piece in Europe. You look at demand for other key petrochemicals is strong. Strong perhaps is not the right word, but it is there. I mean, we're seeing demand in construction, we're just seeing demand in automobiles. Clearly, we're concerned about the semiconductor chip shortage, potential impact on automotive production. But we were expecting, or economists were expecting, a big uplift in production in autos in the second quarter. Now, you know, that's got to filter through, is filtering through the system. It'll drop off year on year. Comparisons will drop off later on in the year, clearly. But, you know, we're at the moment on the second quarter looks still strong, you know, compared to the first quarter. It's difficult to see the current situation changing fundamentally in the near term, certainly over the next few weeks. I mean, I've been looking at the daily price index that we put together at IPEX. So we put together ICIS large for internal use, but you know, you keep expecting to see an inflection point in the US or an inflection point in Europe. And we're not really seeing that. I mean, ups and downs, clearly, but we're still tracking upwards.
So do you think that we might see other companies following Covestro then in increasing their profits guidance? Because they're pretty cautious usually, aren't they, they have been for 2021?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, we'll know, won't we, in the next few weeks, because companies will start to report their first quarter earnings, and then they will give a much rosier view of the year as a whole, because they were being cautious clearly at the earlier on in the year. And you know, we all talk about recovery, economic recovery. Remember, in the US, the massive stimulus package is buoying the situation there, and the economy is expected to do reasonably well this year. European economy is not great. Remember, we're still in lockdown across, and the pandemic situation is terrible in certain parts of Europe. And there are real restrictions on business. But having said that, the chemical industry seems to have avoided so many of the problems seen in other sectors of industry. And if demand is there in the construction sector, which is still operating, in the automotive business, which is still operating, then, you know, you might expect companies that are providing materials into those sectors to be coming up with stronger outlooks for the year.
So, Paul, you've been analysing the impact of the pandemic on global fertility rates, and talk about a baby bust rather than a baby boom. What have you found out?
Well, it's very interesting, Will. You know, we've all grown up with the idea of either being in the baby boom or being the children of baby boomers, because there was this fantastic post-war increase in the number of babies that was born in the States. It was more than 50% increase over the 18 years from 1946 to 64 versus the previous 18 years. If you take Europe, it was actually a bit longer. It went from 1946 to 1970. So you had this fantastic baby boom. And of course, the population went from 2.5 billion in 1950 up to today's 7.8 billion. I mean, just think about that. I mean, 2.5 billion going to 7.8 billion was just incredible. And of course, on the way, people like Paul Ehrlich came out with, seemed to be very sound academic studies. The population bomb was saying, hundreds of millions of people are going to starve because we can't possibly feed all these people. They're all going to die. You're all going to die, was the key message, and so on. Of course, it didn't happen. We did the Green Revolution. We learned how to use fertilizer and so on. But now we're going in the opposite direction. We're now been below replacement level, 2.1 babies per woman in the West since 1970, that 1970 date. And so the population is now expanding because we've got longer life expectancy. People aren't dying at pension age anymore. They're living to be 75, 80, 85 on average. So older people are living. And now, of course, with the pandemic, this has taken it to a stage further where you can now talk about a baby bust going on. So China, which was having 14 million babies being born a year, is now, it seems like last year, have 10 million born. And if you think about the 9 months between conception and birth, any baby that hasn't been conceived by now won't be born in 2021. And you ask yourself, from a common sense point of view, Will, how are people going to be meeting up and forming relationships and getting married or just deciding to settle down and having babies and so on in a lockdown? You can't have a baby on Tinder. You've actually got to meet on the web. So you can see we're now moving. 2020 was pretty dreadful. You saw 20% decline in births, and we're going to see, I think, at least that for 2021. And so we've gone from baby boom through a sort of interim stage into baby bust.
What does that mean then for chemical companies? I mean, why should chemical companies care about this?
Well, who buys our products is the obvious question, isn't it? It ain't machines, and it ain't central banks, it's people. So if there aren't babies being born, you think about the number of products that go into looking after babies. For example, our friend P&G with Pampers, for example. If you've got X million babies and they're growing, you have a lot of demand for Pampers and therefore for polypropylene. If you only have half of X, you have half the demand for polypropylene. Now, you may balance out. You may have more demand for people who are over the age of 55, 60, 65 and so on, but generally speaking, they're a replacement economy. They only buy things when they break. They already own most of what they want. So if you haven't got young people, you've actually got to change your business model, and you've got to start thinking about, instead of, growth is always going to be GDP multiplied by a ratio, you've got to start thinking about, how can I help people to get more value from what I'm doing? In other words, start sell solutions.
Yeah, I was going to say, could you give any sort of examples or give any tips to companies that are trying to adjust their strategies for the longer term to take account of demographics?
Well, we tackled it in the past, and we will probably come back to this again. But let's take the great issue of plastics recycling and the news that INEOS and Trinseo have combined with recycling technologies in order to start recycling polystyrene. Now, this is exactly the kind of progress that we want, that instead of making more virgin plastic what we're doing is we're setting our brains to work at how do we collect up, inverted commas, waste polystyrene? Well, it isn't waste. It's perfectly valuable. It's very valuable molecules, chemical volumes. So how do we turn that back into a usable polystyrene so that if we want to go to Starbucks and have a cup of coffee, or we want to have a takeaway using polystyrene, we can use the polystyrene once, we can collect it up properly, and then we can recycle it so that next time we go to Starbucks, next time we want to take away, there are the same molecules being used again. We're not wasting them. So we get away from the idea of single use. And this, I think, is a critical. When we talk about solutions, one of the ways we're doing that is to move away from single use towards recycled, because in chemical terms, there's absolutely no limit to the number of times you can recycle most of the plastics. So let's go down that track, and that in turn means that what we need, we're making, and then we're reusing it, so we're keeping our costs down, we're making money out of doing different things. The key thing here is, yes, of course, there's some technology, and of course, there's some brain power involved, but there's also actually working out the value chain and moving to a circular value chain. What does a circular value chain mean? It's not the same as the one we've been using up till now. And the more we start to understand that, the more we can start to make money out of it.
Thank you very much, Nigel, Paul, and John. It's very easy to subscribe to our podcasts. Just search on ICIS Chemicals Podcasts on any podcast app.